Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Today, justice has been served. Today, we prove that no one is above the law. No matter how rich, powerful, or politically connected you are, everyone must play by the same rules. We have a responsibility to protect the integrity of the marketplace. And for years, Donald Trump engaged in deceptive business practices and tremendous fraud.
The legal setbacks facing Donald Trump are piling up. He now has 30 days to pay more than $400 million in a civil fraud case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. We'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter Russ Buettner. His team's reporting led to the state's case. Then we go to The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is holding a six-day hearing where over 50 countries are testifying against Israel's occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza.
The state of Palestine appeals to this court to guide the international community in upholding international law, ending injustice, and achieving a just and lasting peace. To guide us towards a future in which Palestinian children are treated as children.
We speak with a surgeon who just returned from volunteering in Gaza. Dr. Irfan Galeria says, "I'm an American doctor who went to Gaza. What I saw wasn't war, it was annihilation." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States is proposing a UN Security Council draft resolution calling for a, quote, temporary ceasefire in Gaza as soon as practicable, unquote. The draft measure also calls for the release of all hostages and an end to restrictions on the delivery of humanitarian aid. It's the first time the U.S. has used the word ceasefire at the Security Council after vetoing previous efforts by other member states to stop the bloodshed. This comes as the U.N. Security Council is voting today on a resolution by Algeria calling for an immediate ceasefire. The U.S. has already vowed to veto it. It's not clear when the U.S. proposal will be put to a vote. The death toll in Gaza since October 7th is nearing 30,000, not counting thousands more who are missing, presumed dead and buried beneath the rubble. Amidst worsening hunger, UNICEF is warning the war-torn territory is, quote, poised to witness an explosion in preventable child deaths, which would compound the already unbearable level of child deaths, unquote. Israeli forces again opened fire at crowds waiting for humanitarian aid, killing at least one person and wounding many others. This is a displaced Palestinian seeking food aid in Gaza City.
Because we want to eat, we are dying of hunger. Why would someone put himself at risk of dying by coming here? It is in order to feed the children. We are dying of hunger and there is no food or drink left in Gaza. There is a famine.
The UN Human Rights Agency says it's received reports of rights violations against Palestinian women and girls in Gaza and the occupied West Bank since October 7th. Israeli forces are accused of arbitrary executions, sexual assault, separating families, and many other forms of inhumane treatment. Degrading photos of Palestinian women were also reportedly taken by Israeli soldiers and shared online. UN experts are calling for an independent investigation into the abuses. In The Hague, arguments are continuing at the International Court of Justice, where Palestinians and more than 50 countries and organizations are testifying against Israel's occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. It's the largest ever participation in the world court's history. Earlier today, the South African ambassador, Vusi Madonsela, said the situation in Palestine is a, quote, more extreme form of the apartheid that was institutionalized against black people in my country, he said. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Malki said that, quote, the genocide underway in Gaza is a result of decades of impunity and inaction. Riyad Mansour, Palestinian envoy to the UN, delivered an emotional testimony Monday.
The state of Palestine appeals to this court to guide the international community in upholding international law, ending injustice, and achieving a just and lasting peace, to guide us towards a future in which Palestinian children are treated as children. Not as demographic threat, in which the identity of the group to which we belong does not diminish the human rights to which we are all entitled. A future in which no Palestinian and no Israelis is killed.
We'll have more on the historic World Court hearings later in the program when we go to The Hague. Israel's Knesset narrowly voted Monday against expelling lawmaker Ofer Kassif, a member of the Hadash party, who supported South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The move to expel him fell short by just 5 votes. To see our interviews with Knesset member Ofer Kassif, go to democracynow.org. Meanwhile, Brazil has recalled its ambassador to Israel. Brazil said it won't retract President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's comment calling Israel's war on Gaza a genocide and comparing the attacks to the Nazi Holocaust, remarks that led Israel to declare Lula persona non grata in Israel. Brazil's foreign ministry has also summoned the Israeli ambassador for talks. In London, a critical appeal for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is underway at the British High Court of Justice in what could be Assange's last chance to stop his extradition to the United States. Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison since 2019. He was charged under the U.S. Espionage Act and faces a 175-year prison sentence for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Julian Assange's wife, Stella, has called the situation a matter of life and death. Before heading into court, Stella Assange addressed her husband's supporters gathered outside for the 2-day hearing.
There is no possibility of a fair trial if Julian is extradited to the United States. He should never be extradited to the United States. He would never be safe. The United States plotted to murder my husband. He's being accused of journalism. This case is an admission by the United States that they now criminalize investigative journalism. It's an attack on all journalists all over the world. It's an attack on the truth, and it's an attack on the public's right to know. Julian is a political prisoner, and his life is at risk. What happened to Navalny can happen to Julian. He has to be released. This farce has to end.
In a controversial ruling in Haiti, a judge investigating the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse has indicted the former First Lady Martine Moïse and ex-Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph, accusing them of involvement in the killing. Court documents accuse Martine Moïse, who was shot and seriously injured in the 2021 attack that killed her husband, of conspiring with Joseph to kill her husband and suggest she was even plotting to assume the presidency presidency herself. The former chief of Haiti's national police is also among some 50 people recently charged. Martine Moïse and Claude Joseph have denounced U.S.-backed acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry for weaponizing Haiti's justice system to persecute his opponents. Henry has himself been implicated in the assassination plot, including by a former judge who previously oversaw the investigation. Political turmoil and bloody gang violence has gripped Haiti amidst mounting protests to remove Ariel Henry from power. Indian farmers are continuing their protest march towards the capital, New Delhi, after rejecting a proposal from the government for a 5-year contract guaranteeing higher crop prices. Thousands of farmers have been camping out about 120 miles outside of New Delhi as authorities have deployed tear gas and erected barricades to prevent access to the city. On Monday, Mahinder Singh, a 100-year-old farmer from Punjab, joined the march.
My family stops me from protesting, but our expenses are not covered. I have 2 children, daughters. I have a family. What choice do I have? Our lands are gone. Our rights are gone. They, the government, do not give us the rights even when we demand them.
In Wisconsin, Democratic Governor Tony Evers signed into law new congressional maps reversing the extreme Republican gerrymandering enacted under Governor Scott Walker in 2011. The move could give Democrats an edge in the swing state, as the whole Wisconsin Assembly and half the state Senate are up for re-election in November. Wisconsin Republicans agreed to the new maps rather than challenge them at the state's liberal Supreme Court, which they worried could result in new district lines more favorable to Democrats. This is Governor Evers at Monday's signing ceremony.
Wisconsin is not a red state. It is not a blue state. Wisconsin is a purple state, and I believe our map should reflect that basic fact. I believe, as I've also often said, that the people should get to choose their elected officials, not the other way around.
In business news, Capital One announced it's acquiring Discover Financial Services for $35 billion, merging two of the country's largest credit card companies. The deal will have to pass regulatory approval as the Biden administration is seeking to tighten rules on financial mergers. Meanwhile, Colorado is suing to block grocery chain Kroger's $25 billion merger with Albertsons. The merger would create the largest supermarket chain in the United States with some 5,000 stores, giving it near monopoly control to set prices and underpay its workers. In Washington state, Japanese Americans are joining immigrant rights activists demanding the closure of an immigration detention center in Tacoma run by the private group Geo Group. The Northwest Detention Center has been the site of several hunger strikes over the years due to inhumane conditions. State inspectors were recently denied entry to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement jail. On Friday, the groups blocked Seattle's federal building as part of their action.
I am here for my great-grandmother, Yoshie Iwamura, who had to give birth to my grandmother, Karen Iwamura, in camp at Minidoka. I say free them all and stop repeating history.
The group Sudo for Solidarity and La Resistencia also mark the annual day of remembrance when Japanese Americans were declared enemies of the state in 1942 and incarcerated. And in Colorado, a former internment camp has reopened its doors as the nation's newest national park. Over 10,000 people of Japanese descent were imprisoned at Camp Amache between 1942 and 1945. National Park Service Director Chuck Sams, the first Native American to hold the position, said, quote, Amache's addition to the national park system is a reminder that a complete account of the nation's history must include our dark chapters of injustice. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Juan, it's an honor to celebrate the 28th anniversary of Democracy Now! With you, with the whole team and our listeners, viewers, readers, and stations. To mark the occasion, we've just surpassed 2 million viewers on YouTube.
Yes, Amy, and who would have thought back in 1996 that this newscast, which was originally supposed to be just a one-year program covering the 1996 presidential election for a handful of Pacifica community radio stations, would still be on the air nearly three decades later, with a worldwide audience that has grown steadily since then. I guess we must be doing something right. It's been an honor as well for me to work with you and the amazing staff of Democracy Now! Over all this time.
Well, it's been an epic journey, Juan, and I'm so glad to be on it with you. Well, we begin today's show with the legal setbacks that continue to pile up against leading Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, even as more trials loom. Trump's latest legal defeat came in a New York court as part of a losing streak in his home state. On Friday, a New York Supreme Court justice ordered Donald Trump to pay $450 million in penalties and interest for illegally inflating the value of his assets in order to secure more favorable loans and insurance for his New York real estate empire. Trump's assets, including Trump Tower in Manhattan, could be used to pay the fine as a 30-day deadline looms. Trump is also barred from running any business in New York for 3 years. Trump's two eldest sons face a two-year ban and were each ordered to pay $4 million. Judge Arthur Engoron also said Judge Barbara Jones will continue to act as independent monitor of Trump's businesses and ordered an additional independent director of compliance at the Trump Organization. In his ruling, Justice Engoron criticized Trump and his sons, Donald and Eric, saying, quote, their complete lack of contrition and remorse borders on pathological, unquote. The ruling came in a case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James, who spoke to reporters after the ruling.
Today, justice has been served. Today, we prove that no one is above the law, no matter how rich, powerful, or politically connected you are, everyone must play by the same rules. We have a responsibility to protect the integrity of the marketplace. And for years, Donald Trump engaged in deceptive business practices and tremendous fraud.
Donald Trump plans to appeal the ruling, which he described as a complete and total sham. This comes as more than $27 million in Trump campaign funds went to legal costs in the last 6 months of last year. For more, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter Russ Buettner. His team's reporting led to Letitia James' case. Russ, we welcome you to Democracy Now!, and it's great to have you with your former colleague, Juan Gonzalez, to talk about this case. Why don't you start off by talking about this unprecedented ruling? What exactly are we talking about when we're talking about more than $400 million that President Trump has to pay? And when does he have to do this, and in what way?
Well, I think what we're talking about is a blow to his personal finances and his business finances that he really can't handle at this point. He doesn't have that much cash. When we looked at him 5 years ago, we had 20 years of his financial records and his tax returns, and he was down to below $50 million in cash, both personally and in his businesses. He's had a couple of one-shot things from selling some assets, an asset he doesn't control, refinanced. As recently as last year, he may have had over $300 million, but our experience with him is that his businesses eat cash generally. They require constant infusion. So if he had that much then, he wouldn't now. He'll have to pay that if he chooses to appeal, which it seems he certainly will. He would have to put up some sort of bond or put the full amount essentially into escrow when he files the appeal within 30 days. If he does the bond, from what we've understood, he might have to guarantee to repay that amount plus an extra 20%. So we believe that he's negotiating now, trying to find somebody, an insurance company, to put that bond up for him. And that would require him to most likely put a lien on some of his properties. But the long game here is that if this judgment holds and withstands appeal, he would most likely have to sell several assets. And that could pose an existential threat to him because he has some assets that make money, those would be the most likely ones to sell, and that would pose a real threat to the rest of his enterprise if that happened.
And Russ, first, hello. We haven't talked in many years. We used to work together at the New York Daily News. But I wanted to ask you, what about the appeal situation here? What's the likelihood, from your sense, that his appeal might be successful, or at least involve a reduction of the fine?
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Juan. From what I've seen and what I've been told by other lawyers who have looked at this, it doesn't seem like there's much chance to overturn the entire judgment. This is a 92-page judgment. Judge Engoron goes through blow by blow each allegation. This was a case that was based on records, not really testimony. The testimony in the case was mostly a way just to get the records into evidence. And it's an overwhelming pattern of them lying to their lenders about what they're doing. And that's the threshold in the law, that you can't mislead your lenders about what's happening. There is always a possibility with these sort of appeals that the judgment might be reduced because Judge Engoron, again, seems to have presented a very well-reasoned argument as to the ill-gotten gains. That's what all of this is. The judge ruled that they're following the attorney general's recommendation, that there was $170 million roughly in beneficial interest rates that they wouldn't have gotten if they had been truthful, and that they were able to sell two assets, a golf course and the hotel in Washington, D.C., that they wouldn't have been able to buy initially if they hadn't fraudulently obtained these loans and continued to lie to their lenders to keep those loans active. So there's some possibility that could be reduced. But it doesn't seem like it would be likely to be reduced down to like $30 million. It seems like it's going to remain a very high number. Should take about, I think appeals in New York generally take about a year and a half to get all the way through. So possibly by this time in a couple of years or towards the end of next year, we might have a kind of final ruling and the ultimate day of reckoning for the Trump Organization.
And also the impact of the judge continuing Judge Barbara Jones as an independent monitor over Trump's businesses and his ordering an additional independent director of compliance. Isn't this actually a much more long-term problem for the Trump organization in terms of being able to conduct its normal way of business?
Well, its normal way of business doesn't seem to be a normal way of business. It's a very unusual organization. I've talked to people who worked there off and on over the last 40 years. One of the unique things about it is there's really nobody there who knows how each business is performing except Donald Trump and his longtime financial accountant, Alan Weisselberg. So the idea that somebody else is overseeing the movements of money there, I think, is really intrusive to him and possibly kind of embarrassing. One of the unique things about those businesses is that they're constantly moving cash from one or two businesses or his fortune from entertainment money into the different businesses. The UK golf courses have all lost money. They required tens of millions of dollars just to stay open. The post office hotel in Washington, D.C., he was pumping $7 to $10 million of new cash into that every year to make up for operating losses. Now you're going to have somebody overlooking that, all of that, telling him what he can't move, trying to maintain the value of what's there to make sure that he can pay whatever judgment comes through. That's a very intrusive process to a guy who had basically spent his entire life in a bubble that first his father financed and then a fortune from entertainment financed. And he didn't have to have answer to anyone, not a board, not an investor, rarely even a bank. That's going to be a hard blow for him.
Judge Engoron said their complete lack of contrition and remorse borders on pathological. Talk about the significance of this, Russ Buettner.
Well, I think it goes really to, it's a very, I think, important element of the appeal. When a judge, when a fact finder, whether it's a judge or a jury, generally comes to a conclusion about the reliability of a witness, and they are basically the only defense they had was their testimony, that them not being reliable, that's very tough for an appellate court to overturn. I don't believe that happens very often. But I think it's also, it's a tough message to send out to the business world. You know, Donald Trump had to get these loans initially because he had defaulted on $285 million in loans on his Chicago tower. That's just money he received and never paid back. So he's really put into a bind. His son-in-law got him introduced to the personal financial, the personal wealth division at Deutsche Bank. That's why he had to ask, he had to promise that he would meet these thresholds every year. He'd keep $50 million in cash and be worth $2.5 billion. That's how he got there. And I think, but I think really what the message is that, like, Donald Trump doesn't do contrition in any circumstance ever. What he does is division. And you see here, he divides the world into people who praise him and people who are horrible people. He's not really addressed the facts of this case, not during the trial. They've been very misleading in the comments that they've made publicly about this. And that's a tough message to send out in the business community at a time when he's going to need loans. He's going to need an insurance bond to come up with this, that he's not a reliable person, that when they sign their name to a document, as they did in this case every year, to say they were meeting these thresholds, that it's really meaningless. And that he thinks that's okay. That's the message he sent out to the business community. I think that's going to be a tough blow for him.
You add to this E. Jean Carroll owing her like 80-something million dollars. You're talking about Trump paying out more than $500 million. Now, how transparent are those who might make loans to them? For example, you've got MBS, Mohammed bin Salman's, you know, sovereign fund in Saudi Arabia, investing $2 billion in Jared Kushner. Not in this case. He's the son-in-law, though, the husband of Ivanka. You know, what about a foreign government giving him that money? Would the public know about this?
That's not entirely clear to me. I would think in a court system, the way the courts usually work, there will be some transparency on that. You would think that the Barbara Jones is a very experienced federal judge and very experienced at these monitor situations and reports regularly to the court. They would be, I think, aware of what's happening there. But any place where there's a potential for outside money to come in and influence the Trumps, I think is a real threat here. And I think that's something that everybody's going to have to pay attention to. That's been a threat to the way his businesses operate for years. You didn't have to pay Donald Trump when he was president. You could just buy a block of memberships at Mar-a-Lago, which happened. And then he took those new membership money out as distributions out the back door. So that's always a threat with him. And our system of governance and monitoring the finance of politicians is not really set up to catch these sort of things. So I think that's something, it's an excellent point, Amy, and I think everyone's going to have to pay attention to that going forward.
And Russ, following up on that, in terms of the Trump Organization investments abroad, assuming that Donald Trump does get elected in November as president again, there will at least be in, hopefully with this court monitoring of the Trump Organization finances, we'll supposedly have a better idea of what his foreign entanglements or the foreign entanglements of his organization would be. Is that accurate?
I mean, I certainly the monitor will, and certainly the compliance officer will. I'm not sure that's going to be their primary responsibility. I think their primary responsibility is to make sure that he's not pulling money out of the businesses. So when the judgment finally comes down, there's not enough there to pay the judgment, and he's already, you know, sort of disgorged it to his own personal finances. I think that's their primary focus. It does give them obviously a window to those sorts of things, but I'm not sure that there would be a mechanism for them to report concern about money coming from someplace else. I think if there's illegal transactions, there's illegal flows of large amounts of cash into some of his businesses, they would certainly notice that. But again, it was really apparent during his presidency that the financial disclosure forms, the oversight agency that looks into those things, is really not equipped to handle something like his very unique situation, where he's getting millions and millions of dollars from just endorsement deals around the world, and millions of dollars from people just staying in his hotels and buying memberships in some of his clubs. And I think we're going to have to, at some point, come to a realization that those systems need to be overhauled.
Did you ever think that your reporting back in 2016 would lead to a Pulitzer Prize and to this epic state investigation into the past president of the United States, who could be the future president of the United States?
I don't think I've ever, like, started a day thinking this might win me a Pulitzer Prize. I get sort of enamored with the idea of digging into these things, and I love figuring out really complicated things. But you never know where it's going to go. I think Letitia James had her own ideas on how to pursue this, and I hope we hopefully help to inform that process a bit. But no, I don't think you ever think that what you're doing on a Monday morning is going to someday lead to, you know, nice awards, or that the involvement of a president of the United States in a multi-million dollar lawsuit.
Russ Buettner, Pulitzer.